Those few words. We have smiles for you so that you will sit back and listen. Welcome. Our effort is to make you feel at home and sit back and hear what is given out in these rooms. And the most important thing that you will hear is the policy of this lodge. One of several listed on the back of the pamphlet. Independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement but doesn't concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or the inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self. A profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. Therefore, has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race or creed or sex, condition or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. We like to note on this wonderful little pamphlet, being in sympathy with the purposes of this lodge is set forth in its declaration. I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate, it being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I myself determine. On the inside of this wonderful little pamphlet are listed several other ideas called Thoughts for Thinkers. However, as you noticed this morning, we began promptly at 11 a.m. The doors here open about 10:30 on Sundays, and we're done by noontime. For instance, today, being April 29th, the topic, the pros and cons of vegetarianism. On Wednesdays, the doors open at 5:15 so that you can come in and spend a couple hours in the library, 7:15. In any case, present at the same time will be a volunteer who will explain to you how to proceed in the library, how much time you have left before the meeting begins on Wednesday. At the present time, we're studying a wonderful little book called The Ocean of Theosophy. We would like to add also on May 6th, a special day. It's called White Lotus Day. H.P. Blavatsky and Theosophy. Certainly, we should be here a few minutes earlier than usual so that we may sit down and be prepared for this one of the most solemn days of the year when we pay honors to those who have left us these documents and the teachings for our benefit. We'd like to read some of the other, but we won't. We just suggest that you stop at the book table and pick up what is called the Declaration of ULT. As is our custom, before we begin our lesson today, we have a little reading for you from another wonderful little book called the Bhagavad Gita. If you're unfamiliar with that, you can always ask after, what does that mean? And if any of the words puzzle you, maybe you may do the same thing because there's an answer. In this particular part, Krishna speaks. The faith of mortals is of three kinds and is born from their own disposition. It is the quality of truth, called sattva, action, rajas, and indifference, tamas. Hear now what those are. The faith of each one, O son of Bharata, proceeds from the sattva quality. The quality of truth, sattva, action, rajas, and indifference, tamas. Hear now what those are. As I stated, the faith of each one, O son of Bharata, proceeds from the sattva quality. Then body, soul, being gifted with faith, each man is the same nature as that ideal on which his faith is fixed. Those who are of the disposition which arises from the prevalence of sattva or the good quality worship the gods. Those of the quality of rajas worship the celestial powers. The yakshas and rakshasas, other men in whom the dark quality of indifference or tamas predominates, worship elemental powers and the ghost of dead men. Those who practice severe self-mortification, not enjoined in the scriptures, are full of hypocrisy and pride, longing for what is past and desiring more to come. They, full of delusion, torture the powers and faculties which are in the body, and me also, who am in the recesses of the innermost heart. Know that they are of an infernal tendency. Know that the food which is pleasant to each one, as also the sacrifices, the mortification, and almsgiving, are of three kinds. Hear what their divisions are. The food which increases the length of days, vigor, and strength, which keeps one free from sickness, of tranquil mind, and contented, and which is savory, nourishing, of permanent benefit, and congenial to the body, is that which is attracted to those in whom the sattva quality prevaileth. The food which is liked by those of the rajas quality is overbitter, too acid, excessively salt, hot, pungent, dry, and burning, and causes unpleasantness, pain, and disease. Whatever food is such as what was dressed the day before, that is tasteless or rotty, that is impure, is that which is preferred by those in whom predominate the quality of tamas.
Thank you. So welcome to today's discussion. Our consideration is the pros and cons of vegetarianism. And what we found interesting about this reading is Krishna, when he talks about what foods to eat, he's saying basically, make your decision on what is right for your body. He's not saying you have to be a vegetarian. The Brahmins would say you have to be a vegetarian. And in that caste system, unless you're a Kshatriya, most all folks are, unless you're in the warrior class. But what caste was Krishna. It said that he was a shepherd. So in his great teaching in the Bhagavad Gita, he's not mentioning vegetarianism. He's not insisting on anything. Well, to give this consideration from a theosophical viewpoint, we're going to mention a few things to bear in mind when we consider these ideas in the light of theosophy, such as one tenet of theosophy is that we are not these physical bodies, we are immortal souls. All human beings are immortal souls, immortal prior to arriving here and after we leave here. And so while we're here, even though we do live in this physical way, we are not this physical way. We've created, it's better to say that we've actually created this place for ourselves than to suggest that we are subject to the ways and means of it. When we learn to work with the law more clearly, with greater understanding, so are we of greater service to everyone around us. But the ideas of reincarnation and karma, or in other words, hope and responsibility, karma being I'm responsible for everything that comes to me because it could not come to me under law unless it was created by me, and reincarnation be the doctrine of hope. Wherever I am, whatever stage I'm in right now, if I work with the law, as I understand it, with right motive, things will work out for the good of all, and I participate in that. So how does that apply to vegetarianism? We all know it's a pretty big idea here. A lot of people talk about vegetarianism. We've read that there's approximately 10 million true vegetarians in the United States. And there's probably little argument from any educated individual that a vegetarian diet can be a very healthy diet. Vegetarians tend to have lower blood pressure, lower incidence of heart disease, lower diabetes, lower incidence of lower body mass, lower weight. We could go on and on. It seems that the choice to be a vegetarian might well be, in physical ways, a very good choice. But is it for everyone? On the other hand, a vegetarian in this environment, living in a body that comes, that is, I mean, if you do ancestry DNA, we're from everywhere. So knowing that we're not Indians from the subcontinent, we don't have 100 generations of vegetarians behind us, knowing that there are certain conditions that these bodies are subject to, we have to realize there are certain concerns if we choose to become vegetarians, very simply. B12 deficiencies, vitamin D3 deficiencies, zinc, iron, calcium, it's not in the food anymore, it's not in the vegetables, probably mineral supplementation would make a lot of sense. So we need to be aware of ourselves. Vitamin D3 we can get from red meat. The only other place naturally we understand is from the sun. However, if we live north of Atlanta, from mid-fall to mid-spring, you don't get vitamin C from the sun. It's not strong enough to hit the oils on your skin. We don't get vitamin D from the sun. The sun hits the oils on our skin, chemically changes it. We absorb that, and that's the source of vitamin D. But the vitamin D from the sun isn't there in this part of the world during the winter. It doesn't matter how much you're outside, especially if you're all bundled up. So there are things to consider. Well, if vegetarian diet really is a healthy way to live, but there are concerns, you know, if you're vegetarian, you know, protein is important. We need to educate ourselves on what to eat. You know, beans, and making beans from scratch, that's a lot of time every day to spend cooking your food. If you're going to be a true vegetarian, you know, we probably all know a vegetarian or two lives on Coca-Cola and french fries, but we're not talking about that. So to maintain a healthy diet is a big decision if it's going to be a vegetarian diet. So let's consider kind of a mix of the two. Suppose an individual, and of course theosophy is not a religion. We would never come here and find anybody saying that the rule is this or the dogma is that. You're expected to follow this. We simply put out ideas, and it's for the individual to decide for themselves how to apply the laws of nature based on how we understand them and how we live. So if we look at the vegetarian lifestyle with all its benefits and open-mindedly recognize that eating meat is not necessarily a wrong thing for every human being. For instance, there's an Ayurvedic treatment for protein deficiency, and it's called 4 ounces of red meat every day for 2 weeks. So the question is, would it be helpful if the carnivore or the omnivore or the flexivore, whatever we call it, suppose he just dialed down the amount of meat? Would that have a positive effect on the health of the individual, if we were just mindful of what we ate, how much we ate? And the answer is, on the one hand, really, centenarian cultures are not vegetarian cultures. Centenarian cultures, typically they have meat in the diet about 10%. For this world with its 7 billion people, to continue, you know, if we theoretically were to eat meat 3 times a day with 7 billion people, it's unsustainable. We can't do it. There must be a reconsideration. Currently, of course, there's probably a lot of different numbers that we could talk about, but throughout the world, there's about 58 billion farmed animals, and that doesn't count fish from the sea. In America, the USDA says the number is close to 7 billion just in America. Is it sustainable? Well, that depends on what you call sustainable. It depends on what you call meat, how efficient it can be. One factory farm of 37,000 head of cattle goes through 25 tons of corn per hour. Now, here's the catch. Cattle aren't supposed to eat corn. Cattle are supposed to eat grass. But because of what's going on and who we are and what we're demanding, the choices that we're making, we're receiving meat that is so full of antibiotics, so full of disease because of the disease that the cows incur when they don't eat the right food, that this is a big part, perhaps, of the decision of an individual who's going to make certain choices about what they eat. So, if it's just from a health perspective, it's really not, it's pretty cut and dry. Probably, we could say, the less meat we eat, probably the better for our own health and for the health of the ecology. But some people would say, you know what? It's completely immoral anyway. I'm a vegetarian because I am appalled at the idea that I would kill something that I haven't given life to. And we totally get that, completely. So if it's looked at from purely a moral perspective, that's a personal choice. A lot of times someone will say, well, I don't eat meat because I'm spiritual. And being this moral, you know, I'm taking a spiritual step forward. That's a consideration. There are others who, well, let's take a look at that, actually. For people who won't eat meat because of morality, do you wear clothes that are made from animals? There's no judgment here. You know, find no fault. We're asking the questions. Do you wear cosmetics and other personal items that's made from animals? Do you take medicine? that was derived from animals, from animal suffering. HPB's masters said that at the time in their day, vivisection was, we're not going to, we keep forget exactly the words, but the agony and the pain and the suffering that animals go through vivisection are such that it should not be done. It should not be done. So what do we do when we're developing medicines? We test them on animals. So if we're not going to, if we're going to be vegetarians from a point of view of morality, are we going to decline medicines? How many animals suffer that we never even know about because the medicines that they were tested for never made it to the market because all the animals died when we were testing them, so it never made it to the market. That's a lot of animals. If you've ever had your blood tested, if you go to the doctor, he says go to the lab and they draw your blood, except for the blood chemistries, pretty much everything else that they use to test your blood is done with antibodies that are derived from goats and sheep. So if you're tested for cancer, if you're tested for a liver panel, a kidney panel, your thyroid panel, all the cancer markers, anything that's known as an immunoassay, that was developed from the blood of animals. And to get one that works where the antibody is specific and sensitive enough, they have to go through over 100 animals to find the one. And when they find the one, they make that animal the factory of that antibody for as long as they can keep it alive. And it's kind of an amazing science. Okay. So from the strictly moral perspective, there are decisions to be made. It's not an immoral decision to eat meat if you know that my body is stronger and healthier when I eat. And it's not wrong to say, but I'm not going to kill animals. Theosophy doesn't say that butchers are not allowed to be theosophists. If the butcher is a student of this philosophy and he has his business or he has his job, he has his duties, taking care of his family, who is anyone to dictate to him what changes he should make? Who's saying that what he's doing is wrong? People need meat to eat. So from strictly a moral perspective, there is no one directive or dogma that can be given to such a pluralistic society of free thinkers in which we live. Each one is the authority for himself according to the truth as he knows it. Well, so that's the moral side of it, but what about strictly the religious side? Because if I'm a Hindu or a Jain or if I'm a Buddhist and I follow the teachings of my religion, then and I don't eat meat, then that's a sign that I'm more spiritual. And theosophy would say, hold on, folks. If you're not eating meat because your priest tells you not to eat meat, that has nothing to do with spirituality. That has to do with you following the rules. So if you're not eating meat because you want to prove that you're more moral than the next guy, that has nothing to do with spirituality because you're just trying to prove something about yourself. It's a selfish motive in the one. The other one, in the one with morality, if it's a selfish motive, it's not going to bring you to the next step in spiritual living. On the other hand, if you're doing it because the priest says so, you're ignorant of, not you, but a person who is ignorant of the facts and just does what his priest says to do, does not take any spiritual steps forward. But if someone personally chooses to refrain from eating meat because they feel appalled at what goes on and they don't want to participate, well, then all the better. All the better. So what does theosophy say? Where are we going with this? Theosophy, as was said with the reading from the Bhagavad Gita, we are first spiritual souls. We are self-conscious thinkers using these bodies. And it would seem that all the good people of the world, in their inner nature, if they do know and if they have learned some of the problems, all the problems that is caused by eating meat, and could wave their own little magic wand, they wouldn't eat meat. But all the spiritual souls in the world come into this planet with baggage. And while inwardly we may know certain things are true, we may know that a certain way to eat would be the ideal, outwardly, the karma that we bring with us are certain both desires and requirements on the physical plane. You know, some of us are descendants from Neanderthals, and you still need red meat. So what we have to work with is the result of past karma in previous lives, not necessarily in the previous life. It could be from 10 lives ago that comes forward into this life that we're dealing with. That doesn't mean that our character has not continued to advance beyond that, but it means that issues and problems from the past have come back. And for us to pretend that we can just wave that magic wand and make it go away is simply not true. Now, that being said, a theosophist is someone, you know, there's you know, anybody who, you know, is of average intellect, has an inclination for the metaphysical, is interested in religions of the world, wants to understand in deeper ways of what's going on within me, how does this reflect out into the world, and who's willing to, you know, sacrifice for others and do for his neighbor and do certain things, even though it may appear to others to be the wrong thing to do, but you have the character because you'll do the right thing. You're probably a theosophist in certain ways. You're a self-conscious free thinker. Make your own decision. And if that's the case, you're probably on a certain path. Those who are on the path, and really all of us are on the path, there comes a certain time or a certain point in the spiritual development of a human being when certain desires completely fall to the side, or when the opportunity or the door is open or the portal is available, when certain desire or certain decisions need to be made. And at that point, he or she has reached a point where there's to be no more meat eaten. So we wouldn't say that we can tell or that we know. Whoever is at that point, it is very definitely a decision that's made by each person. But we're talking about a level of development where you're at a point where if you make that decision, you're not going to be bragging about it. You're not going to be finding fault in others because they're doing this when you know they should be doing that, because in fact, you've already learned that I was there too. How grateful I am to be here now. But if I'm not wary and if I start finding fault and judgment with others, that's my own fallback. So there's a teaching of the progress of the pilgrim, and those who are on that path can know eventually the decision is going to have to be made. But at the same time, what really matters in the theosophic diet is that the priority is to feed the inner man the right thoughts, the right attitudes, the right emotions. Our soul, our character, the strength and the growth of our soul is a function of the experiences that we have and the quality of those experiences and what is worthy of assimilating into the soul. That is food for the inner man. It's probably a lot more important to consider, you know, we will grow more spiritually in the moment based on what comes out of our mouth rather than what goes into it. So with that, we probably all have a lot of experiences and opinions and approaches toward this. We'd love some contributions and questions. Yes?
One of my favorite things on this subject is in the Bible, where it says, if it offends my brother that I don't eat meat, I will eat meat. The important thing being how we make others feel and respond.
Thank you. So, you know, this all falls under the heading of universal brotherhood. Universal brotherhood is another way of saying we're all infinitely interconnected. And to view animals as our brothers would be, to view them as they truly are. So a lot of people will not eat because of that, and it's to be respected. Yes.
But therefore, it's true then that the ideas that we hold will manifest. It's not the other way around. We don't, if we become a vegetarian and our mind is not embracing it or doesn't comprehend it, and we're just doing it because we were told or it seems to be the fashion, it's like everything in our life. It all begins in the mind. The ideas that we hold to be true, and you just mentioned universal brotherhood, the unity of all of life. And if we develop that idea, things manifest.
So this contribution here is when an individual decides to become a vegetarian, ideally for the right reasons, innocently because they want to take a step in the right direction. What's the right thing to do? Well, maybe vegetarian will help. Vegetarianism will help. But if they don't release certain false ideas that they bear, such as an identification with themselves as a separate being from others, or if they don't release the idea such as I can't make decisions for my own soul, I go to church and I'm told what to do, the step forward isn't happening. We have to take responsibility for everything we do. And here's a tough consideration. The teachings say even when it comes to drugs, you know, drugs are worse than alcohol. Alcohol is worse than red meat. And if you are prescribed an opiate from the doctor, no theospis is going to tell you not to take it. In fact, it's the physical plane. Your body's on the physical plane. If the doctor who is knowledgeable makes the prescription, it's probably worthy of considering. But that doesn't relieve you of the personal responsibility and the karma of taking the opiate. It's not the same as a person doing it clandestinely. You're not morally doing the wrong thing, but you're still going to suffer the physical results if you take too much. Is it part of the doctor's karma? Yes, but it's also yours. So be the authority for yourself spiritually and making medical decisions for your body. Yes.
Well, one of the things that the philosophy speaks to is how thoughts and feelings impress food. And we know, we've read and heard that when we're preparing food, even if it's vegetarian or not, that thinking good thoughts for our families as we're preparing it, being aware of the line of process that brought that food to us, the people who picked it, maybe the person who slaughtered that animal. When it comes to us, there are all these impressions involved with that type of food. And then if we're preparing that food with good thoughts and love, that it's being transferred as well. But at the same point, that animal that has been slaughtered has had this terrified last few minutes of his life. And this is whether it's organic, halal, kosher, or factory farming. That animal is terrified. Those impressions are going into that food, and then people are eating it. So there's like all sorts of issues that go into it.
Really, there are a lot of things that go into it. In fact, if we recognize that, of course, we're not just this body, but there is the astral around us, and a wider, brighter experience that's there. If we were sensitive to it, the Vedas say that the digestion of our food actually begins when we see it and pick it up in the market. We actually begin affecting our food metaphysically for us from the point that we pick it up and bring it home. So, it's all about vibrations. It's all about, now in large part, this is all about the seat of desire and emotions. It's about aesthetics. Yes, it's about obviously feeding the body, but it's also about the aesthetics and the quality of the food. Now, but it's also about the mind, because if we consider the effect that we, and a number of us have studied this here, it's amazing the effect that our thoughts have on water. And to say this briefly, there was very definitely a physical science series of experiments reproduced and shown that when a drop of water is frozen and crystallizes, the shape of the crystal is very much a function of the thought in the mind that of the person who was present, and even a function of the word on a plate next to that drop of water. So when it freezes and the word hate is present to it, the vibration of that causes a crystal to be made, and it's all warped. When it's love or peace or charity, it's amazing. The shape of that crystal is more, it is a more fully formed symmetrical crystal. It's a beautiful thing, and it's proof to the person who chooses to YouTube some of these things. It's called Messages from Water. Messages from Water. And then on top of that, also, it was demonstrated when Buddhist monks meditate in the presence of the water when it's being crystallized, that crystal is not then a two-dimensional crystal. It actually forms a three-dimensional crystal that looks like a Christmas tree. So if we realize that when we're preparing our food, what percentage of all of our food is water? Maybe 80%? Just our thoughts in the process of making our beautiful, delicious food can have a real impact on us as individuals. There's a hand here.
But our body is made up of water.
Right.
So you're, this is so dynamic that we really are affecting everything by how we think, how we feel, and how we act. We color our day. We color our day, and if water is so sensitive to our feelings and thoughts and emotions, well, our fellow human beings are 80% water, 75%
yep.
water. We're affecting them the same.
Mm-hmm. So this is one of the examples of the ideas that we hold. So for instance, we talk about the inner man, the soul who each one of us is. The outer world to our inner self is our physical body, okay? Now, if we choose to hold the idea that our physical body is what and who we are, and it's separate and different from your physical body, even though the reality is, in spirit, we are one. There's no separation of any of us. But if we don't release the idea that you're over there, I'm over here, we're separate, then we're going to be operating from this side of the coin, ignorant of that side of the coin, ignorant of how we perceive each other, ignorant if we even care if each other is there, so to speak. And so if we release that false idea and recognize that universal brotherhood, which is a synonym for the infinite interconnectedness of life, if we realize that everybody and everything is interconnected, and we think and act from that basis, then could be, if we were able to really keep that in the forefront of our mind, could be that we would be acting and thinking in a lot of different ways through the day than probably a lot of us do right now. Yeah.
However, for the best and most spiritual reasons in the world, we might try to be a vegetarian and find that our Western body will not let us be healthy. We know that Mr. Judge actually had this as a problem, and he had to go back to eating meat. So our karma, for whatever reason, has us in a Western body with a particular kind of stomach, and we do require meat. So perhaps the solution to that would be to go meatless more than having meat, to make it a more balanced one.
Yes, Mr. Judge did say that. He said that he was a vegetarian for 9 years. And finally, in that that Western European body that he was using in that lifetime, he decided, you know what, regardless of his experiences elsewhere and other, it just wasn't going to work. He was not as healthy as he could be, and he went back to eating some meat. It could be that some of us have experienced living at least a certain amount of time where really we were eating, you know, all the vegetables that we could, raw salads and everything, with a little meat here as well. We get that. We can. It's easy to test, check, and verify how much healthier we can live while still eating a little meat that's necessary for the body. But it's for each individual to test for himself. It's not some kind of a program that the lodge would put on. Yes.
We're wondering, is it meat itself or is it protein? There are many more sources of protein now that are available to someone who chooses not to eat meat than there were 10, 20, 50, 100 years ago. So is it the meat itself or is it protein?
Yeah, so is it the meat itself or is it protein? Well, we're certainly not going to claim that we're biochemists, right?
Just one.
But the emphasis, you know, the emphasis from those who we've read is, you know, the emphasis is beans, beans, beans. If you're a vegetarian, you got to know, you know. And, of course, there's whey powder and there's all sorts of, but there's ways to know. You know, protein deficiency is a very real thing in Western bodies who are vegetarians. And one way to know is if your joints start to get achy. If your joints are getting achy, what that simply means, it's a protein deficiency. The first thing your body does when there's a protein deficiency is it takes the protein out of your synovial fluids. So it's not effective and your joints get achy. So that would be a test for the individual who is now a strict vegetarian but maybe hasn't been doing it for very long. Have you experienced those kind of achy joints? In which case, we have to investigate how to get that protein if we're not going to get it from meat, right? But like we said, one of the Ayurvedic treatments for protein deficiency is 4 ounces of red meat every day for 4 weeks and then go back to your traditional diet in the back.
It's interesting that more and more in the West, children are being born vegetarian and their family has to adjust to it to serve that child differently for its health.
Very interesting that was brought up. We have a personal experience with that, if we could share it. Our best friend, while we were in our 20s, and he's still a very good friend now, when he was a toddler at the size of able to be put in a high chair with a tray, his parents told him he would throw the meat on the ground and he wouldn't eat it. But he would eat everything else. And his parents recognized it for what it was. They raised him in a family of flexivores. They raised him the vegetarian that he chose to be. Maybe he didn't, you know, or maybe that he had to be in that body, whatever it was. But interesting, you know, the karma of this gentleman was that he had certain things to prove to his friends through his life. And one of those things was by the time he got into college, he was so strong and so in shape and so absolutely vegetarian that he won the lightweight boxing championship for that whole area for the college championships as a vegetarian. It was unheard of, but true. Yes.
What is the difference between vegetarianism and veganism?
Right. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, what is the difference between vegetarianism and veganism? Really, vegetarianism can mean different things to different people. It can mean, to some, we had one friend who, from here, she said, nothing with a face. That's a vegetarian. She's nothing with a face. Then there are those vegetarians who won't even eat cheese or eggs, right? And so they call that lacto-ovo-vegetarian. But then when you go all the way and will not eat an animal product, that would be a vegan or a vegan. A vegan, that's the difference. A vegan will not have an animal product, a glass of milk, a piece of cheese. That's the difference. Yes?
Or wear leather.
Oh, yes. And they're much more conscious. But of course, we're not, you know, but will they allow to have their blood tested to find out if they are that sick? In situations where animals are tested for that. So it's consideration. Yes?
We have always thought, before we ever came to theosophy, that vegetables have feelings too. And that's because I had a tree I talked to. So,
so you know.
I knew. So I think part of the reasoning, as you mentioned earlier, it gets twisted. If one stops eating meat because to do so, to continue to eat it, encourages the slavery of the animal kingdom for nothing but our own pleasure.
Yeah, it's
plus waste how many resources that could go to people that really need it. Like you mentioned, the massive amount of corn. Well, the water that it took to grow that corn, we're stealing from people while subjecting the animal kingdom to hideous treatment. So we think that alone would make any thinking human being want to be a vegetarian, and then they would cease it only if they failed by their health.
If one does the math, you know, how much corn or hay or grass it takes to raise one cow, that amount of food, if instead you use the resources to make, you know, lettuce and cucumbers and tomatoes, and could feed so many more people, It's perhaps about the most inefficient way to feed the human race is to feed them with farm-fed animals. Yes?
One thing that we haven't mentioned too is the methane that the cows produce. They say it's actually affecting the ozone layer of our air. But we wanted to make another comment. We had a discussion with a friend last week regarding, well, what is really the difference between eating the plant kingdom and eating the animal kingdom.
Yep.
And it's like, when you really think about it, you wonder, but the thing is, the animals are,
they're
more
conscious.
They are not,
they're more conscious, but they are more conscious.
But they are more conscious. And there has to be something that animals and humans can eat. Otherwise, there would be, you know, everything would be dead.
So
it's, you know, the issue with the plant kingdom is that they aren't as conscious, and they, and then again, it's the impressions that one puts out while preparing food.
Yes, well, there are those, generally they're called fruitarians. We've heard that even that the Jains have a practice where they won't even eat the plant. They'll only eat the fruit of the plant that's fallen off the plant. They'll only eat the nuts from the tree that have fallen on the ground. where does one draw the line? That's a choice. Because if we're, how do you make the distinction between eating, you know, if everything is life, if all is evolving, if really the form is not the reality, but the reality is the intelligence that dwells within the form, that flows through the kingdoms, that over time continues to flow to higher and higher levels until eventually, after some vast period, a certain aspect of universal mind is individualized and lit up as a human being. Well, what's the, in that sense, behind the scenes, what's the difference between the plant and the animal? It starts to get vague, but there's always intuition, and we probably don't have English words to describe it. One thing we found incredibly interesting was, you know, we've all seen these, what do they call it, electroencephalograms of when they put the thing on your head and see this. And so we saw an electro, you know, they compared electroencephalogram of a human being. It was a mess. Then they put one on an animal. We think it was a dog. And it was the same idea. And it was actually just less of a range, maybe in a different area, less of a range. And then they put an electroencephalogram around the ball, the root ball of a bush. Guess what? Brainwaves. Very interesting. So we're all here. You know, it's all one life. And we have, there are certain decisions that each has to make for himself and set example for others. Yes.
When we investigate vegetarianism or that kind of lifestyle, we have to go back and look at history. You know, the Chinese are a very ancient culture, and they have a whole system devised of vegetarian eating that provides complete proteins, and they've found through fermentation of miso and tempeh and other things that through a mold you get all the essential amino acids. So, you know, we see that in Japan, we see that in Asia, where there's been vast populations and they've resort to eating other things. You know, even in some cultures, insects. You know, but we think that as we become more universal and more mm-hmm. conscious of our brotherhood mm-hmm. and of our, you know, intertwined, that we begin, these things will manifest themselves naturally. But we have to start thinking just like this. Just thinking like this is just so helpful.
There's a recipe common to all the indigenous tribes. Which is a combination of beans, and we're going to say corn, but corn to different tribes and different civilizations may be a different grain, but the combination of beans and certain grains offers the full spectrum of amino acids, offers the full protein. So that may be a hint. But on the other side of it, here's another hint. When meat eaters eat meat, there's a chemical in the body that's released. It's called DMAL, and it's a cancer-causing chemical. So the chemical's released, and then your body has to do what it needs to do, in particular, I think, when it's red meat, cooked red meat. And that's an issue that you... But interestingly, when a vegetarian is fed a piece of red meat, they don't produce DMAL. And so perhaps the implication there is that Mother Nature has a window where in some ways it's not inappropriate for human beings to eat meat at a certain level. Just food for thought. Yes.
There's a wonderful book. It's an older book. It's called The Secret Life of Plants. And it's actually a rather scary book because you realize that indeed plants, you know, do react. we think it might have been some of the first tests that were done on plants with the electrodes and seeing how they would react. And if one said, you know, brought a match near one of the plants, the reaction of the EEG was dramatic. Whereas if they went and talked nice and talked, you know, petted or whatever, you know, it was a totally different type of reaction to it.
So we're talking about, is a plant conscious? Is a plant intelligent? We wouldn't say a plant is intelligent. We would say that there is intelligence within the plant kingdom, and there is awareness. There is awareness within the plant kingdom. When certain plants are attacked by gypsy moths, they warn the other trees. When a certain type of, not a worm, but a caterpillar, starts eating away at a leaf on a particular tree, the first thing it'll do is cut off the leaf at the stem of the leaf, because it knows, so to speak, that the tree will release a type of hormone that'll make that leaf taste bad. So it cuts off the vein of the leaf and then eats the leaf. Interesting. Also, the root system of trees have been shown. And now, of course, when we talk anecdotally, you know, we want to stick with theosophical principles, so we're just giving an example of that this makes sense. Test for yourself. But a scientist gave a speech on TEDx and was able to demonstrate that when there are plants which are starving of carbon in the area of those which are healthy, the ones that are healthy will release carbon in the direction of the other plants. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating. Yes.
We think it was Chandra Bose from India who did this particular test, which shows sensitivity to light around the plant. They wired up, stuck the plant's leaf into boiling water, and it reacted, of course. Then they dropped a live shrimp into the boiling water, and the plant went out of its mind.
Wow.
Right off the top of the sheet of
amazing
recording. So they're sensitive to the life that is around them, and that's a very special kind of intelligence.
So we see how these theosophical conversations can take a life on their own. It's very interesting information, all of it related to what? To the decisions that we make. Eating, like speaking, can be recognized as a sacred act, or it can be degraded. It's all a matter of our attitude, our thoughts, and our motives behind how we live our life and how we make our decisions. We'd like to read maybe a couple of examples of some of the things that HPB, Madame Blavatsky, said about eating animals for those who are that far along on the path, which it would seem everyone eventually in time would end up. First of all, eating meat has the effect of clogging and weighing our brains and bodies and hampering and retarding the development of our intuition, inner faculties, and powers. It retards the progress. Interesting how it clogs and weighs the brains and bodies. And are we not talking about heart disease, et cetera, as an example? Every kind of animal tissue, however you may cook it, still retains certain marked characteristics of that animal which it belonged to. Occult science teaches and proves to its students that this coarsening or animalizing effect on man is greatest from the flesh of larger animals, less for birds, still less for fish, and other cold-blooded animals, least of all when he eats only vegetables. So if we're going to choose, and we have to eat. So the choices that we make should be choices consistent with how we know that the health, the longevity, the strength, and the vitality of this body is going to work, and use this body in service to all for the right processes, and we're doing it all for the right reasons. So with that, we will adjourn the meeting, and we would like to mention first that June 2nd, we're going to have a Saturday symposium. We do this once a year. From 1 to 4:30, there will be a symposium where we will take a look at ancient myths for the new age. And there will be several, we think, four presentations of 15 or 20 minutes each, and then always time for thoughts and discussion afterwards. Ancient mythology has its place in modern times. The archetypes are still here, and they're useful if we bear them in mind. So, our meeting is adjourned.
Okay. That's a tough topic, I think.